Hello, everybody. Welcome to this podcast extra of the TED Radio Hour. I'm Guy Raz. And if you listen to our show, then you'll know that we play a lot of excerpts from TED Talks that are given at TED events and conferences around the world. So as the summer winds down, and if you can hear from behind me, I'm standing on the beach right now. We thought it would be really cool to play a mostly unedited session from the recent TED conference in Vancouver this past March. And it was a session that I hosted. It was called Beauty in the Brain. And we invited a bunch of famous, well-known TED speakers back to the TED stage to kind of revisit some of the themes that, in some cases, made those speakers really, really famous. You're going to hear Tierney Teiss talk about how just being in the natural world engages your brain. You'll hear from Dan Gilbert, who was on a recent show of ours about happiness. He's talking about how we make decisions that our future selves regret. You'll hear from Jane McGonigal. She talks about a video game that is better than morphine at relieving pain. 17-year-old Taylor Wilson, who built a nuclear reactor in his garage. And Jill Bolte Taylor, probably the most famous TED speaker of all time. She comes back to the TED stage. She's, of course, the neuroscientist whose life totally changed after her TED talk and after she had a stroke. So that's a pretty good start to get you going for this all-star session. It's called Beauty in the Brain from TED 2014. Enjoy. Wow. Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. I even wore my TED Red All-Star Converse for this very session. This session, Beauty and the Brain, is going to be amazing. We've got incredible speakers, all of whom you know, many of whom have inspired you, back here on the TED All-Star stage. And our first speaker drives that connection, makes that very connection between beauty and the brain. You may remember her as the Mola Mola woman from her 2003 talk on those amazing giant ocean sunfish. She still studies them. She hasn't stopped studying them, but she has recently turned her gaze to your brain under the influence. Please welcome Tierney Teiss to the TED stage.
Oh, it's great to be here. Well, you know, we're always looking for some quick, painless way to focus our brains, aren't we? Coffee, Ritalin, B12, brain games. Brain fitness market's projected to reach $6 billion by 2020. Well, what if I told you there's something exists today that delivers amazing results, cheaper, with no side effects? It increases concentration and focus, reduces stress and anxiety, it speeds healing, sparks creativity, and you can't OD on the stuff. What is this amazing substance? Well, E.O. Wilson tells us in his theory of biophilia that just being surrounded by bountiful nature rejuvenates and inspires us. Now, nature's calming, healing effects was formally investigated by Roger Ulrich, a psychologist in the 1980s, and he found that patients whose hospital rooms looked out on trees had faster healing rates and requested fewer strong pain medication than patients whose windows looked out on brick walls. But you know, what I find really interesting is that just staring out at nature does something mysterious to our minds and bodies. Last year, I started working with Nalini Nadkarni, another TED speaker, and we started putting nature imagery into the exercise yard of an Oregon prison. Talk about nature deprivation at its most extreme. And we've gotten some pretty remarkable preliminary results, and what's equally exciting is this growing number of compassionate prison staff members willing to give this simple tactic a go to lower inmate violence and aggression. What a potentially cool, low-cost tool for our incarceration nation that houses 2.3 million inmates, many of them suffering from mental illness and destined to be repeat offenders. Now, you know, speaking of incarceration, most of us don't really get out all that much either. As of 2010, humans have officially become an urban species. And the average American spends 90% of their time indoors. 90%. So granted, you know, cities do have their nature. Bob, that's for you. But we, you know, by and large, we have become very separated from the landscapes and seascapes we evolved from. So could nature imagery maybe help defray that growing deficit? And if so, how? Well, we know from fMRI studies that measure blood flow to the brain that there's a particular region of the brain that processes scenes and scenery. Actually, this is work that is Nancy Kanwisher, who'll be presenting tomorrow. Don't miss it. And we also know that the brain responds differently to rural and urban imagery. And we know that the right amygdala fires up in response to watching animals' imagery. But there's so much more we don't know. For instance, which habitats best stimulate or calm us? Is habitat preference in the eye of the beholder, or is it hardwired into the hominid brain, as many evolutionary psychologists suggest? If we had answers to questions like these, we could optimize the creation of nature imagery to maximize its social and therapeutic good. And that's what we're doing with pilot funds from National Geographic. I've teamed up with Nalini Nadkarni and Tan Lee, and we're using mobile EEG headsets to measure brain dynamics in response to different biomes. And we're using beautiful imagery. This is all part of a new field I'm calling neurobiophilia, the science of how nature engages the brain. Of course, it's always better to be out in real nature, but sometimes it's just not possible. So for all those times we're separated from the wild, be it in hospitals, nursing homes, office buildings, space stations, supermax prisons, we're hoping that this kind of research can help provide that one well-guided touch of nature to reconnect us all. Thank you.
It's amazing. Can you, like, how would you imagine this kind of tool could, you know, might be used for somebody suffering from depression or PTSD? I mean, what would your vision be?
Well, I think, you know, now we can capture nature with such incredible resolution. I mean, to the limits of the resolution of the human eye. And so there's so much information that we can draw on, but we don't know exactly how to optimize it for particulars, like for someone who's depressive or someone. And so we can look at that and see if it can be optimized to particular disorders.
Like exposure therapy.
Exposure therapy. And then also we're looking at audio as well, so with sound, without sound. I mean, the questions you can ask are so numerous, but nature imagery as a therapeutic tool, I think, is really untapped.
Tierney, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, our next speaker has given two seminal talks, one on why we make bad decisions, and the other, of course, on the science of happiness. That talk has been seen by more than 8.5 million people. He was just on the TED Radio Hour recently. His latest research looks at how we look at ourselves. Please welcome Dan Gilbert to the TED All-Stars stage.
Well, it's humbling to be in a session called Beauty in the Brain because you know which one you're expected to be. You know, at every stage of our lives, we make decisions that will profoundly influence the lives of the people we're going to become. And then when we become those people, we're not always thrilled with the decisions we made. So young people pay good money to get tattoos removed that teenagers paid good money to get. Middle-aged people rush to divorce people who young adults rushed to marry. Older adults work hard to lose what middle-aged adults worked hard to gain. On and on and on. The question is, as a psychologist that fascinates me, is why do we make decisions that our future selves so often regret? Now, I think one of the reasons I'll try to convince you today is that we have a fundamental misconception about the power of time. Every one of you knows that the rate of change slows over the human lifespan, that your children seem to change by the minute, but your parents seem to change by the year. But what is the name of this magical point in life where change suddenly goes from a gallop to a crawl? Is it teenage years? Is it middle age? Is it old age? The answer, it turns out, for most people is now, wherever now happens to be. What I want to convince you today is that all of us are walking around with an illusion that history, our personal history, has just come to an end, that we have just recently become the people that we were always meant to be and will be for the rest of our lives. Let me give you some data to back up that claim. So here's a study of change in people's personal values over time. Here's three values. Everybody here holds all of them, but you probably know that as you grow, as you age, the balance of these values shifts. So how does it do so? Well, we asked thousands of people. We asked half of them to predict for us how much their values would change in the next 10 years, and the other is to tell us how much their values had changed in the last 10 years. And this enabled us to do a really interesting kind of analysis, because it allowed us to compare the predictions of people, say, 18 years old, to the reports of people who were 28, and to do that kind of analysis throughout the lifespan. Here's what we found. First of all, you're right. Change does slow down as we age. But second, you're wrong, because it doesn't slow nearly as much as we think. At every age from 18 to 68 in our data set, people vastly underestimated how much change they would experience over the next 10 years. We call this the end of history illusion. To give you an idea of the magnitude of this effect, you can connect these two lines, and what you see here is that 18-year-olds anticipate changing only as much as 50-year-olds actually do. Now, it's not just values, it's all sorts of other things. For example, personality. Many of you know that psychologists now claim that there are five fundamental dimensions of personality: neuroticism, openness to experience, agreeableness, extroversion, and conscientiousness. Again, we asked people how much they expected to change over the next 10 years, and also how much they had changed over the last 10 years. What we found, well, you're going to get used to seeing this diagram over and over, because once again, the rate of change does slow as we age, but at every age, people underestimate how much their personalities will change in the next decade. And it isn't just ephemeral things like values and personality. You can ask people about their likes and dislikes, their basic preferences. For example, name your best friend. Tell me your favorite kind of vacation. What's your favorite hobby? What's your favorite kind of music? People can name these things. We ask half of them to tell us, do you think that that will change over the next 10 years? And half of them to tell us, did that change over the last 10 years? And what we find, well, you've seen it twice now, and here it is again. People predict that the friend they have now is the friend they'll have in 10 years. The vacation they most enjoy now is the one they'll enjoy in 10 years. And yet, people who are 10 years older all say, that's really changed. Does any of this matter? Is this just a form of misprediction that doesn't have consequences? No, it matters quite a bit, and I'll give you an example of why. It bedevils our decision-making in important ways. Bring to mind right now for yourself your favorite musician today and your favorite musician 10 years ago. I put mine up on the screen to help you along. Now, we ask people to predict for us, to tell us how much money they would pay right now to see their current favorite musician perform in concert 10 years from now. And on average, people said they would pay $129 for that ticket. And yet, when we asked them how much they would pay to see the person who was their favorite 10 years ago perform today, they say only $80. Now, in a perfectly rational world, these should be the same number. But we overpay for the opportunity to indulge our current preferences because we overestimate their stability. Why does this happen? We're not entirely sure, but it probably has to do with the ease of remembering versus the difficulty of imagining. Most of us can remember who we were 10 years ago, but we find it hard to imagine who we're going to be. And then we mistakenly think that because it's hard to imagine, it's not likely to happen. Sorry, when people say, I can't imagine that, they're usually talking about their own lack of imagination and not about the unlikelihood of the event that they're describing. The bottom line is, time is a powerful force. It transforms our preferences, it reshapes our values, it alters our personalities. We seem to appreciate this fact, but only in retrospect. Only when we look backwards do we realize how much change happens in a decade. It's as if, for most of us, the present is a magic time. It's a watershed on the timeline. It's the moment at which we finally become ourselves. Human beings are works in progress that mistakenly think they're finished. The person you are right now is as transient, as fleeting, and as temporary as all the people you've ever been. The one constant in our life is change. Thank you.
Is it possible that some people prefer the person that they were 10 years, 20 years before?
Yes, of course. It's very possible that people prefer who they were in the past to who they are in the present and even who they will be in the future. But what's interesting in our data is it doesn't much matter whether the change is for the better or for the worse. Yeah. People just can't envision it. They think they've arrived at a point in time in which they're finally fully formed, the person they always were meant to be. And finally, I'm the real Dan Gilbert. Here I stand before you, underestimating how much change I'm going to experience between now and the end.
It's absolutely fascinating research, and I think very optimistic research. So
thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan
My
Gilbert.
Pleasure. Thanks.
So in 2010, our next speaker argued that if we want to solve things like climate change, hunger, poverty, if we want to improve our lives, then we all need to play more online games. And I, for one, have been doing my part. I hope you have too. But now she comes with fresh scientific data to actually back up her argument to show that gaming really can improve our lives. Please welcome Jane McGonigal back to the TED stage.
Thank you. 5 years ago, I hit my head and suffered a traumatic brain injury. And as I shared in my 2012 TED Talk, I invented a game called Super Better to help my brain heal. Since then, I've become fascinated with how video games and virtual worlds might help other brains heal and become stronger, more resilient. I discovered a whole world of clinical research and scientific experiments, and today I want to share with you four of the most intriguing breakthroughs so far. So this is Snow World, created by researchers at the University of Washington. It's a 3D virtual reality game designed to help hospital patients who are undergoing treatment for severe burns, which is widely considered the single most painful medical procedure. Patients play Snow World by wearing a virtual reality headset and using a joystick to navigate the frozen landscape, exploring ice caves, throwing snowballs at snowmen. It sounds really simple, but studies show that Snow World reduces pain in the most severe burn cases by 30 to 50%, which is more effective than morphine. It's true, there is a video game today that treats pain more effectively than morphine. You're wondering how it works? Well, fMRI studies show that players become so cognitively absorbed in the virtual environment that they are neurologically incapable of receiving and processing all of the pain data from their body. Brains can only absorb and process so much real-time information. And this game empowers patients to choose where to focus their attention on a source of data other than the nerves in their skin. Amazing. Now, what about a more familiar game, Tetris? Most of you have seen or played this at some point in your lives, but did you know that Tetris can help prevent post-traumatic stress disorder? It's true. Psychiatrists at Oxford University completed a study showing that playing Tetris immediately after a traumatic event can block your brain from forming visual memories of the trauma, which prevents flashbacks and nightmares, two of the most difficult to treat symptoms of PTSD. How does it work? Well, Tetris essentially hijacks the visual processing center of your brain. It stops you from converting the images that you saw during the trauma into long-term memories. So no flashbacks, no nightmares. I think we should all share this tip as widely as possible. As soon as possible, after you see or experience something traumatic, play a visually absorbing pattern-matching game like Tetris. Candy Crush Saga should work too, and this can help you avoid the most painful symptoms of PTSD. All right, now what if you want to change your real-world behavior, but you need a little extra motivation or willpower? A game can help here too. This is Tree Project, created by researchers at Stanford and Georgia University. Tree Project situates you in a virtual forest complete with blue skies, chirping birds, and giant redwood trees. When you start the game, you look down, you notice your avatar is holding a chainsaw, and the game instructs you to use the chainsaw to cut down one of the trees. It takes you 2 full minutes of sawing back and forth with your joystick, which is rumbling with haptic feedback. The tree falls, you see it fall, you hear it fall, and there's a haptic feedback floor in the room that shakes with a thud when the tree hits the forest floor. Now, the amazing thing about Tree Project is that players who were immersed in this virtual world for 2 minutes changed their real-life environmental behavior for an entire week. The biggest difference was that immediately afterwards, they used 25% less paper product, 25% less tree, and this difference was not observed in individuals who read about deforestation or who watched videos of deforestation. The trick only worked if you had that firsthand immersive experience of cutting down the tree yourself. Now, maybe we should all spend more time in virtual environments that help us really see and feel the global consequences of our actions. It could help us unleash our natural abilities for conservation and compassion. The last update I'm thrilled to share with you is about my own project, Super Better. The University of Pennsylvania recently finished a randomized control trial of Super Better for depression. Now, you may remember Super Better teaches you how to turn any real-life challenge into a game, complete with power-ups, bad guys, quests, allies, and, of course, epic wins. And according to the results from the Penn study, Super Better is very effective for treating depression. In fact, for the typical player, Super Better eliminates 6 symptoms of depression in 6 weeks of play. So we are thrilled with that result, and it's just the beginning. We are currently completing an NIH-funded clinical trial of Super Better for traumatic brain injury, and I'm writing a book analyzing the data from our first 250,000 Super Better players. So when you add it all up, games are treating pain, preventing trauma, curing depression, changing real-world behavior for good. I would say these are very exciting times for all of us who are investigating improving the power of games to make us stronger and help us heal. Thank you.
Jane, can you give us an update on the status of your research? Where is it headed? You know, how's it going?
Yeah, so we have NIH funding through the end of the year. Things look good for the second phase clinical trial, but I'm also looking for allies. I need people to join forces with me. We're looking for more resources because Super Better, it's becoming a movement, and basically, I need help. I need more than NIH funding.
All right. So. hint, hint. Anybody interested in helping Jane, you can find her in the
That would be
area.
Great.
What are you playing now, just briefly, just out of interest?
I am trying to beat my mom to level 400 of Candy Crush Saga. It is the first video game she has played in 20 years. So, and she's at level 87, and I'm at 243. So I'm totally going to beat my mom. Yes!
Jane, thank you so much. Jane McGonigal.
Thank you.
Thank you. At TED in 2012, then 17-year-old Taylor Wilson described how he built a nuclear fusion reactor in his parents' garage when he was 14. Last year at TED, he described his dream of building these small modular nuclear fission reactors, powerful enough to generate enough energy for a small city. And he's back to give us an update on where his big idea is headed. Please welcome Taylor Wilson.
Thanks, Guy.
So you, last year, you wowed us with this vision for creating these modular reactors that could power cities, they'd be safe, you could scale them up. Yeah. They were pretty easy to deploy, you would use off-the-shelf hardware technology. How close are we to that becoming a reality?
Yeah, well, I mean, the nice thing about this power reactor technology, fission, is it's not a physics problem to overcome. It's simply a how are we going to put it together, a manufacturing problem. So most of material science has been worked out. And so, yeah, it's essentially, it depends on, you know, human capital and capital itself and factors like that. But it's as fast as we can design and put them together. So 5-10 years to market, that's probably the range that we'll see. If it's 5 years to market, it'd be 3 or 4 years to an actual critical prototype of these reactors. But the nice thing about it is not only is the technology very simple behind it and the physics has been solved, but it's a small class of reactor. It's only, you know, say less than 100 megawatts and scales all the way down to the couple of megawatts range for, you know, certain remote applications. Forward operating bases, Department of Defense, remote communities, things like that. And, I mean, that's where we're going in power generation anyway, this idea behind distributed generation for a variety of reasons. But, yeah.
What are some, because you now have a company, you run a company, and this is what you aim to do. What are the biggest challenges, regulatory, energy, safety? I mean, what do you face?
Yeah. Well, I mean, from a regulatory standpoint, these reactors are nice because they have had the potential to release radioactivity removed. So the idea is you still have some kind of nasty, gnarly stuff in the core, and that's why, again, eventually I think we'll see fusion, although we're a ways away from that. So there's still gnarly stuff in there, but because you've removed the chemical or the hydraulic potential to release the radioactivity, from a regulator standpoint, you know, you still have to take account that there's nasty stuff in there, but... a lot of the regulatory complexity goes away, and so does a lot of the cost. I mean, the problem with nuclear power right now is that, you know, 9 times out of 10, when you have a bad thing happen, the plants perform well, but they perform well in that kind of narrow operating window. And so nuclear power is very expensive because you're essentially building 2 or 3 plants in one when you take in the backup systems necessary to prevent, you know, an accident and a loss of coolant situation like Fukushima. So
give us a sense of where you see our power landscape, a North American power landscape, sure, in 10, 20, even 50 years.
Sure. Well, like I said, we're moving more towards this distributed generation model. And, you know, I think that's essentially for 3 reasons. I think one of the biggest is efficiency, right? If you have big gigawatt scale power generators, and your consumers of it are far away, you're losing a lot of electricity from, you know, resistive heating in the power lines. And so you're making more electricity than you actually have to use. The second is grid reliability. So you look at like Superstorm Sandy, took down the grid in the Northeast, and terrorist attack, things like this can bring down the grid. And then lastly, if you look at renewables, they're very much pro-distributed generation, the idea that every house could have a generator and solar panels. Now you need, with certain renewables, you know, solar, wind, things like this, you need redundant, you know, essentially power storage, which we don't have in quantity right now. And if we put in quantity, it would be very expensive. But, you know, the idea that if you have an electric car or two parked in your garage, then you can charge with solar. That kind of microgrid solution, I think, is where we're moving to, where every city, town, or even house has its own generator. But we're going to need baseload power on top of that. I mean, renewables are great, and in some areas they make sense and they're cost-effective, but we're not there yet. And even if we do reach, you know, very high-efficiency renewable power, we're still going to need the baseload power on top of that. And the cleanest way to do it is, and the densest way to do it is with nuclear energy, because it is so dense. And if we can make it as safe as living next to a solar farm, then I think we've solved a lot of the energy problem.
Just briefly, one last question.
Sure.
It's a personal question.
Yeah.
You are 18, right?
19 now.
You're 19.
19, yeah.
And I know you're tired of the boy wonder jokes, but the reality is, I mean, you would be, if, and a lot of universities were interested in you, you would be a freshman in college now. Is there part of you that is like conflicted about having made the decision not to go to university and to go right into what you want to do for the rest of your life?
Sure, exactly. I mean, that was my huge decision, right? Because I'm a very social, outgoing person, and I wanted to kind of follow my friends and into college. But I think I realized there was a huge opportunity here. I had a lot of people wanting to fund me, support me, et cetera, to do what I wanted to do. The technology is needed, whether it be the medical technology, the security technology, the energy technology. And, you know, I can get the social stuff in other ways, right? I can go to parties on the side. So, I mean, I miss that. And, you know, I'm growing up kind of, and I'm missing a little bit of my childhood. But, you know, one thing I'll say, and you know, we talked about this on the phone when you called me, and that's the fact that, you know, science is making a career out of what you do as a child, right? It's the whole exploration, right? For me, science, and at its base, whether I do business or engineering or whatever else, science is my passion. Because for me, it's like climbing a mountain. It's exploring the unknown, right? And that's what we do as kids. And as a scientist, you know, I never have to grow up, right? I can constantly feed that creativity and exploration. And I hope to do that, and maybe I can solve some big problems, you know, along the way.
Well, Taylor, you're awesome. For
thanks.
All our sakes,
yeah,
I wish
thanks.
You
appreciate
great,
it.
Great luck. Thank yeah. you so much.
Thanks so much.
So you may remember our next speaker from this.
So this is a real human brain. This is the front of the brain, the back of the brain with a spinal cord hanging down. And this is how it would be positioned inside of my head. And when you look at the brain, it's obvious that the two cerebral cortices are completely separate from one another. For those of you who understand computers, our right hemisphere functions like a parallel processor, while our left hemisphere functions like a serial processor. The two hemispheres do communicate with one another through the corpus callosum, which is made up of some 300 million axonal fibers. But other than that, the two hemispheres are completely separate.
So, as everybody here knows, this was really a watershed moment for TED and for Jill Bolte Taylor. That was one of the earliest TED videos to go viral, mega viral. Almost 15 million people have seen that TED Talk today. It's my great honor and pleasure to welcome Jill Bolte Taylor back to the stage.
Everybody, nice to be here again with Ted. Yes, I'm sorry.
No, it's. I think everybody's waiting yeah. with bated breath to hear yeah. you. That talk was, of course, about your personal story, surviving a stroke. Mm-hmm. At the time, you were a neuroscientist, and mm-hmm. you became your own research subject. Mm-hmm. What happened after that talk? What happened to your mm-hmm. life?
Within the first 3 months of delivering that TED Talk, it was posted and it went totally viral. And within 3 months, I was chosen as one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. Nice little girl from Indiana. What do you do with that? I was interviewed by Oprah as the premier guest on her new Soul series, and then Penguin Books purchased the rights to my Stroke of Insight, and it proceeded to go immediately to the New York Times bestseller list. That was the first 3 months. So Ted, you know, I just say Ted and I went viral together, and it's been a lovely experience. Yeah, changed my life entirely.
We got some questions from TEDxers around the world. I've got two of them here. One from Peggy Stefan from TEDx Excelsior, or Peggy Stefan. She asks, how has your experience in suffering a stroke changed your research? You are, of course, a trained neuroscientist. How has it changed that?
Well, more important than that, when the stroke happened and I shifted completely into the right brain and I had no left brain, that meant I was no longer going to be in the lab because I no longer had a left brain and I lost all of my science knowledge. I had to go back and relearn that. And what I learned along the way through the process of growing up more right-brained is I'm much friendlier now than I used to be. So although I love cells and I think that neurons are the most beautiful thing in the world underneath the microscope, me being in a lab is no longer the best place for me. So I have completely shifted my teaching in the medical school into now I'm teaching on a more global level. So everything has completely shifted for me.
You lecture, you work with kids. Tell us what you're doing now.
Well, I keynote all over the world. I keynote for medical organizations, any professional organization, corporations. It's like anybody who has a brain would like to have a better idea of how to get your brain to do what you want it to do. We do have two very different ways of perceiving the world, one more open and expansive and one more detail-based and on a schedule. And really, for me, everything has shifted away from being the scientist in the lab to being able to come in and help people understand And we do have the power to pick and choose who and how we want to be in the world. And every ability we have because we have cells that perform that function. So I try to help people recognize, when are you already in your right brain experience? When are you in your left brain experience? And how can we create more of that middle path? How do we really find that balance between the two? So it's, you know, I think our first job as human beings in the world is to love one another. I think that is our primary compassionate way of being. It is the essence of our right brain. And when we come into the world through that compassion and that love and that openness, then all the details, we can play together. We can approach one another with curiosity and compassion.
I guess that's a bit of a window into where you're headed next.
Where am I headed next? Really into the children. I started a not-for-profit, of course, Jill Bolte Taylor Brains. And I care about educating the public about the resiliency and the beauty of the human brain. I care about the children. My not-for-profit is working with Goldie Hawn and the Hawn Foundation. They have a beautiful program called the Mind Up Program, which is actually teaching children about the amygdala, about the hippocampus, about the different regions of the brain, and helping children have some emotional accountability. And with emotional accountability comes a level of higher cognitive accountability. So I'm doing that. And then there's a movie on the horizon. And if and when that ever happens, it will take you on that journey into who you are as a whole, into who you are as a right brain. It will take you there, and it will let you make your own decision. Would I come back, and what would I be like if I were a little bit more right-brained in the world?
Before you go, any last thoughts?
You know, I'm really grateful to this organization. TED changed my life in 2008. When that TED Talk happened, I was allowed to be vulnerable. I opened my heart. I went out on the limb in that presentation. And this organization, you held me in that beautiful space of safety. And together, we made what that TED Talk became. And I will always be eternally grateful because my life has changed. It's given me the opportunity to really be who I am in the world. So sure. I'm thankful.
Sure, thank you. Hey, thanks for listening to the Beauty and the Brain session from TED 2014 in Vancouver. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back with three new shows after Labor Day, three new shows in a row starting September 5th. I'm Guy Raz. Until then, enjoy the rest of your summer, and we'll see you soon.